This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 263, was recorded on March 18th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment process. JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from secular inflation to how far the long end of the Treasury curve can go, to why Juliette thinks the stock market stands on firmer ground than some skeptics are suggesting. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, when Patrick's chart deck will be titled, Is Volatility Set to Return? Next week, my feature interview guest will be billionaire Canadian financier Robert Friedland. That interview is based on my two-part interview with Robert on the subject of what it's really going to take to green the economy. The two-part series is already live right now at smartermarketspod.com. So in the Macro Voices interview next week, Robert and I will discuss how to invest in the green revolution. The point is, next week's Macro Voices feature interview will assume you already listened to the prerequisite two-part series. So please do that between now and next Thursday so you're ready for next week's feature interview. Again, you'll find the two-part series linked in your Research Roundup email or at smartermarketspod.com.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into this S&P 500. I mean, we've been gravitating higher all week, but in the post-FOMC statement period, we see the markets here getting a little bit wobbly off the highs. We're down about 30 points at the time of recording. We're at 39.30 here. What's your take on the S&P 500 here?
Well, yeah, what you say is true. We are down today, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, the way I see the big picture here is the market couldn't even go a whole month without making a new all-time high. And furthermore, when it almost did, people started to panic. Oh my gosh, what's going on? So, you know, clearly the signs of a top or an imminent top are all there. But I think this market is incredibly difficult to call because, yes, all of those late stage bull argument, euphoria stage, you know, we're close to the end. Those arguments all make sense, but so does the argument that this is just the beginning of a crack up boom and that we've got much, much higher to go. Frankly, I'm quite happy not to have any directional trade in either direction. Juliette DeClercq is going to tell you in today's feature interview that she thinks the market is on firmer ground than some skeptics think. I guess that tends to support the crack up boom argument. One way or another, Patrick, if I was going to be in this equity market at all, I think something like the rolling straddle strategy, which you talk about a lot at Big Picture Trading, would make a lot more sense than a directional bet here, because I could see it going either way.
For sure, Eric, because in the post-OPEX period, when volatility tends to start up, so there should be some big movement starting next week. We'll see which direction that is. And let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, though, which generally, it's been pinned near 92, a little higher, a little bit lower, but just winding up. Do you think there's an imminent big move coming here in the dollar, or is it just going to be more of the same?
No, I don't think so. You know, everybody's talking about today's move as if it's, you know, hugely big upside. Look, we still didn't make it to 92 today. It's 91.76 as we're speaking at about 2:30 in the afternoon. Maybe we'll get there by the end of the day, but frankly, I doubt it. So we don't have any big news of a breakout. We're still in a consolidation. And it's certainly, you know, it's close. It's definitely something to watch, but we don't have any signal yet.
All right, Eric, let's move on to crude oil because today, big down day. We're down over 7% right now at the time of recording. I'd love to hear your take on what's happening here in the crude market.
Well, of course, everybody is trying to ascribe a reason to today's action. I think the biggest reason, frankly, is because, look, ever since the 1st of November, this market has gone nothing but straight up. And we got to the point of testing the highs that the market was unable to break through in January of 2020, before there was any word of any coronavirus crisis coming in early January of 2020. So, you know, we hit a pretty major resistance level. And at the same time, you've got a bearish EIA report. You've got a lot of changing perspective on inventory and so forth. We finally had a build that really was a build this week. So there's a number of factors, but I think the main one is just that it's been up so much so hard. In any case, though, Patrick, this is, you know, a game changer today. Today's tape action broke through a trend line that was unbroken since November 2nd, at least on the continuous chart. On the contract chart, it's a little bit more iffy as to whether we really broke through that or not. We also closed below the 21-day moving average for the first time since early February. And in fact, we closed below the 34-day moving average for the first time, I don't know, since a long time ago. So this is what it looks like when you see the beginning of a big crash. And certainly at the close here, we're looking at a $5 five-day gap. That's the difference between the five-day moving average, which is right at $64 right now, and 59.60 or so, which is where we're trading just a few minutes after the pit close. This really looks like the market has changed direction and we've got a trend change. There's almost always a bounce when you get this wide of a five-day gap. The bounce itself doesn't mean anything. It's what happens after the bounce. So I expect we'll get a bounce and probably get back up at least to the 34, if not to the 21-day moving average. But then what? You know, is it the beginning of a new downtrend? Certainly, if we had another $10 a down from here, we've already had $7 a down at least since, or more than that, actually. We're actually approaching $9 down from the very high. You know, maybe it goes to 15 before this is over. It still wouldn't really change my very bullish long-term outlook. I think we're in a bull market here. We anticipated here on Macro Voices that when we got to that key resistance level or resistance zone between 65 spot 65 and 66 spot 60 on WTI, we thought it was maybe going to top there. And sure enough, that's what happened. It got all the way to 68. Now we're going to go the other direction. The question is this just the beginning of a sideways consolidation, or are we going back down into the 40s? I think anything's possible, but it doesn't change my view that we're still in a secular bull market in commodities and particularly in crude oil.
Eric, why don't you touch on the inventories?
Well, Patrick, we actually had a bona fide build of 2.4 million barrels in crude oil inventory. And what I mean by bona fide is in the past few weeks, we've had much larger builds, but they were offset by even bigger drawdowns in finished products. This week, it's not just crude oil. It's crude oil building 2.4, gasoline building 472,000 barrels, distillates building 255,000 barrels. So it's builds across the board. The only drawdown was Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 624,000 barrels. So in this situation, we see there ought to be at least a little bit of downward tape action. I think this was more the straw that broke the camel's back than the real cause of the change in price direction. It was after inventory that the selling started, and it just continued, especially from about 7 o'clock on Thursday morning. And it'll be very interesting to see how far this goes. We were way overdue for a pullback, so now it's a question of how deep of a pullback before this bull market continues.
Eric, so it looks like gold put in some sort of a short-term low at the start of March. And since then, for about 2 weeks, we've been gravitating a little bit higher, but nothing impressive. I mean, we're trading around 1730 at the time of this recording. Do you think there's more downside here in the short term for gold, or do you think that's going to be a more meaningful bottom?
Well, Patrick, maybe there's an argument that that 1675 that we saw was the bottom and it's all uphill from here. But frankly, we need a daily close over 1800 in order to get above the channel resistance line that we've been following for several months now. So that's still quite a ways above the market. We came off the bottom and we got about halfway to where we need to get to in order to signal an actual trend reversal. And already it looks like this rally is kind of losing steam. Hasn't really rolled over with conviction yet, but let's give it a few more days. It looks to me like maybe it's about to. There's still hope here, but a long way to go before we have a signal that the trend is reversed. I tend to lean still towards lower numbers, and I think Juliet DeClercq is going to have some explanation as to why she thinks lower numbers are also possible for gold. As a long-term gold investor, I already see this as a buying opportunity. I've been buying gold mining shares here just today, in fact. Juliet has a shorter, more institutional trade duration window, so let's see what she says in the future interview.
Eric, let's talk about that 10-year treasury yield, because it was really a good chance that the FOMC could have been a turn point for putting in a short-term high on yields, but no sign of that. After just an hour of pulling back, suddenly the 10-year treasury yield today is making a fresh high. We're at 173 at the time of recording. When does this stop?
Well, remember just last week, David Tepper was the guru of choice, saying he thought that the 10-year yield had backed up as far as it was going to go. Oops, guess not. And, you know, it's not just the 10-year yield. Look at the opposite action at the other end of the curve. The three-month T-bill is now yielding one basis point. That means with a one basis point bid-ask spread, if you're on the buying side of that, you're getting nothing for your three-month T-bill. That's a scary proposition when you're really at truly zero interest rates on the three-year T-bill. So now it's a question of how much farther that zero number goes out on the duration curve and whether or not we get to negative numbers at some point. It's going to be interesting to see. In any event, Patrick, I don't know where it ends. I'm asking all of our feature interview guests. This one's beyond my pay grade.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq. Now, Eric, why did we invite Juliet back onto the show this week?
Well, the primary reason is because these treasury yields are not beyond her pay grade. Juliet has a fantastic record when it comes to the accuracy of her treasury calls, so I really want to see how she interprets this treasury market. And besides, it's just been too long since we've had her on the show. And in any event, Patrick, I'm always happy to have Juliet back. I do want to mention, however, this interview was recorded on Tuesday before the FOMC, so you don't have all of today's action reflected in the conversation.
Eric's interview with Juliet DeClercq is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors the Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Part one of my interview with billionaire financier Robert Friedland, exploring what it will take to green the global economy, is up now at smartermarketspod.com. And part two airs this coming Saturday morning. Do you remember when Kyle Bass suggested that I interview Abex founder Josh Crum to explain all the dimensions of Abex Technologies and its business plan? That interview airs tomorrow morning, Friday, March 19th, as a full-length Macro Voices Spotlight episode. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to separately subscribe to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free new podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq, who is perhaps best known for her incredible graphs and charts. So you're not going to want to miss the download for this week's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads, just above Juliet's picture and immediately below the green Donate button. Bonsoir, Juliet. It's great to have you back. I want to start with the question we're asking everyone, which is, secular inflation, is it really about to happen? Some people say this is the late 1960s. We're about to have a massive inflation driven by all of the government stimulus and everything that's expected. And frankly, at this point, I really hope you're a deflationist because we've been looking for one.
Well, secular questions are difficult. I think I want to emphasize that, you know, we're really at a very high uncertainty point. Nonetheless, that's a key question, and I will constantly revert to it in my 2021 outlook and beyond. But really, I think a fair answer is that we do not know. So why we don't know? Well, we're talking about unpredictable, nonlinear human behavior, exacerbated by the high level of macro uncertainty emerging from the 2021 global macro revolution. A revolution towards a policy mix that is standing on two legs, fiscal and monetary. The first one, which is very highly political and therefore volatile, and the other one, which basically embodies a new and much more dovish but largely undefined reaction function from the Fed. Also, consider the added risk of pervasive social media groupthink. So let's think about it. You've paid people to sit on their butts for a year, sometimes more than they were paid when they were working. Will they happily return to work for less pay? Or will the Phillips curve kick back in, forcing CEOs to bid up wages? Recently, with my clients, although I'm navigating towards answering this key question, I'm trying to stay away from speculating on animal spirits and try to focus on what's priced and what we know for sure. I think really another important element to consider, and that will take me to chart zero of my chart pack, is that to answer this question, you have to also realize that the main risk to reflation is actually inflation. And you can see that for yourself on chart zero. The question there is, at what point do higher prices become self-limiting by curbing down demand? And that's a theme that basically has been stable over the past, basically like all decades on my chart. In my opinion, there is a non-trivial risk that the US break-even curve, so the inflation curve, continues to flatten and invert in a move that would signal stagflation and eventually a return to disinflation. And that's obviously if and when the fiscal thrust recedes. So just to answer your question, at this point, I don't expect runaway inflation, but I keep my mind widely open on the subject as the risk skew on inflation has certainly shifted dramatically over the crisis and certainly for the foreseeable future.
Well, that brings me to a closely related question, Juliet, which is the recent sharp backup in long-term bond yields has raised fear among a lot of investors that it could short-circuit the economic recovery, lead to an equity crash. There's every imaginable, you know, story out there about what this means. What's your take on it?
So I think to answer this question in the clearest possible way, I would like your listeners to consider the second chart of my chart pack, which happens to be chart one. Yes, markets are calling the Fed's bluff and refuse to believe that it will, or perhaps that it can, fulfill its new FAIT mandate, which is flexible average inflation targeting. Why? Because the new mandate is extremely vague so far. And I stress that this interview is taped before the 17th of March, which is just before the next FOMC. But I don't expect any resolution on this salient point. So the Fed has refused to quantify the lengths of time when inflation would be considered for the average, but also what sort of overshoot would they consider acceptable. So far, all we have is a vague promise of a moderate overshoot. This tells us very little and therefore leaves markets to their own interpretation. So as a result, as you can see on chart one, you can see that the Fed hikes have been priced as early as late 2022 now, which is a reaction function that is materially more hawkish than officially argued by the Fed. So looking on the chart, you can see that five-year inflation breakevens are now compatible with sustainably achieving the 2% target. On this, I want to add that the Fed targets core PCE rather than CPI, on which breakevens are priced. So there is a circa 30 basis point wedge between PCE and CPI, which basically explains why breakevens at 2.5% only anticipate a tiny overshoot. But what's more worrying at this point, as far as the Fed's mandate and credibility are concerned, is that the breakevens curve is dangerously flattening and is actually unprecedentedly inverted, which means that whilst the target could be reached in the medium term, markets do not currently anticipate that it would be sustainably met in the longer run. So to answer the question of whether higher rates is a problem, we probably need to go through why it would be a problem for equities and eventually for financial conditions, which in turn would become a hurdle to the economic recovery. Well, a dominant equity sector, especially in the US, is priced on lower real yields. So it's the famous growth sector. And the fear is that it may crash, eventually dragging down global indices. As a reminder, growth sectors historically tend to trade like long-duration assets. Why? Because they are made of new or pioneer industries full of promises of exponential earnings growth in the far future. These promises to deliver exponential earnings in the long run is easily revalued through lower long-term real yields and collapse term premia. And this basically allows the sector to become positively correlated with bonds, which was the main countercyclical monetary policy lever over the past business cycle. So that's like for 10 years, some of you traders who haven't been trading before the global financial crisis would only refer to this market dynamic. As an aside, it was also the main source of disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street, because bad economic news became a positive driver for the bond-like growth sector.
Juliet, having now established that the legitimate concern is a valuation concern for the growth sector, are higher yields threatening an overall bear market as a result?
So again, for those who were not trading pre-global financial crisis, after which financial repression became the main source of monetary loosening, it's important to reiterate that periods of bear steepening, as happened year to date, actually tend to coincide historically with stellar earnings growth and equity performance. This should not be a surprise. The US yield curve tend to bear steepen when higher yields are warranted fundamentally. And the market dynamic is one that allows the front end of the curve to move higher without disrupting the positive repricing of the long-term cyclical outlook. So that's something you can verify for yourself on chart 2 of my chart pack. Bear steepening periods have tended to coincide with periods of equity price acceleration. Conversely, the yield curve tends to bear flatten when higher yields result from an unwarranted hawkish tilt in the central bank's reaction function. This is what happened in 2017-18, when Powell's Fed mistook a short-term bounce of confidence from a supply-side stimulus, so that was like basically Trump's tax cuts, with a demand-led sustainable cyclical bounce. So it led to 2 years of bear flattening, which basically culminated in the 2018 Q4 crash and the Fed's subsequent 2019 dovish U-turn. Similarly, such bear flattening dynamic is what burst the tech bubble in 2000. Having cut rates by 75 basis points in 1998 to prevent the LTCM collapse from causing a recession, the Fed started to raise rates from mid-1999 in a bid to tighten financial conditions and counter the speculative tech mania. Reflecting overly tight financial conditions, the US yield curve then started flattening, eventually inverting in February 2000 and triggering a three-year equity bear trend, only interrupted for a few months at the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, by a bout of bear steepening, which actually allowed an equity bear market rally of almost 25%. So my message here really is not to look at absolute yield level That's really not what matters for equity indices or even for the real economy in general. But what we need to look at is how this yield level relates to the outlook. So in other words, restrictive yields will tend to flatten the curve, whilst accommodative yields tend to steepen the curve. So on chart two, you can observe that the US yield curve has been bear steepening, which highlights the current market belief that higher yields have not turned restrictive and do not imperil the cyclical outlook. In fact, given the faster vaccination rollout and constant over-delivering on fiscal stimuli in the US, I would argue that financial conditions have probably become more, not less, accommodative this year. And the reason is that they are driven by macroeconomic improvement rather than a hawkish tilt in the Fed's reaction function. So I think the recent yield shock is very unlikely to trigger an equity bear market, quite the opposite, in fact.
Julia, your charts are so enticing, I can't help myself. So please forgive me if I seem to be questioning you. But I hear your point. But if I look at chart two, you can see that the curve bear steepened back in late 2001, yet the equity bear market lasted well into 2002. So is that contradicting your analysis?
So Eric, that's a great question and a point that's been raised by my clients. The reason the 2001's bear steepening did not end the bear market is valuation and basically the existence of an equity bubble. However, including on Macro Voices last year when it was heavily against consensus, I have consistently argued against the equity bubble narrative. And I will really stick to my guns on this one and refer you to the chart three of my chart pack. So if you look at the chart three, which basically measures the developed world cyclical outlook against SPX forward equity risk premium. Again, many of your listeners will ask, why using the equity risk premium? So let me go through that quickly again, because it's important. When an investor buys a stock, he's buying the future cash flow potential of a company. And the valuation of this cash flow will depend on the real yield of the alternative safe investment, which is naturally US Treasuries. So the equity risk premium allows a thorough comparison of valuations across business cycles. And that's really the key point here. On top of this, the earnings yield is also, in my opinion, a sound way to assess current valuation levels to expected earnings, because the ratio accounts for both dividends and retained earnings. Some talking heads argue today that equities are in a bubble just on the basis that their dividend yields are lower than treasury yields. And I think that's a nonsense. So, of course, the huge caveat is that growth prospects of a company are a critical consideration when using earning yield. Stocks with high growth potential will typically be valued at a much lower earning yield. So in 1999, what happened? Amidst the internet revolution, it was certainly an argument to rationalize a negative equity risk premium for both SPX and the NASDAQ. And I think in retrospect, markets got massively carried away, and the lack of a spread cushion between the forward earnings yield and the 10-year real yields were a loud warning signal. Eventually, rising yields, real yields burst the bubble and triggered both a bear market and a recession. This allowed valuation to basically become more realistic and realign with fundamentals, as you can see on my chart, which is using the DM composite PMI to picture the cyclical outlook in the developed world. In other words, even accounting for a much greater growth environment in the late 90s, equity markets on aggregate were grossly overvalued, which is not the case today. In fact, I actually argued with my clients recently that the recent shallow correction actually offered value and remain quite bullish stocks on aggregate, which is basically a stance that I've retained since late March last year.
Juliet, that gives us a great foundation in the aggregate, but it seems to me like the big story that you hear in the financial media this year is sector rotation. Everybody's talking about cyclicals versus value and value versus growth and so forth. So as we go back to my second question, which was about the backing up in yield, what do you think this means in terms of sector rotation?
So another great question, and of course, there are large valuation disparities, as your listeners will see for themselves on the chart 4 of my chart pack, which pictures Euro stocks estimated earnings yield, which is a typically cyclical index, together with SPX and the NASDAQ, which is a typical growth index. So for SPX, the forward earnings yield today is just above 5%. Above the 10-year real yield, and it was literally negative in 2000. And as you rightly point out, a fairly priced aggregate hides wide disparities between sectors. So the earning yields cushion that you get in a cyclical heavyweight like Euro stocks is 90 basis points, and you get a cushion which is 70 basis points tighter with the NASDAQ. So in this regard, one should really question whether the e-commerce and technology sectors, which are positively correlated to treasuries, should really still trade at such a massive deep premium to cyclicals and value sectors. Let's think about e-commerce and digital services penetration. It basically got bumped in 2020 as stay-at-home orders became prevalent. But if you were not using Amazon or got yourself a Netflix account over the crisis, how likely is it that you will jump into the services over the next 12 months? My really strong belief is that our focus should be on the absolute strengths of value and cyclical sectors rather than on the relative weakness in growth sectors. And I think it's really worth considering that growth sectors have greatly matured over the crisis. So you can actually see on chart 5 that in the UK and the US, e-commerce penetration has seen 4 to 5 years of growth in 2020. And this really begs the question, will it stick? And of course, I hear more and more stories of those thriving in their lives in a more appealing digital virtual world compared to the dull reality of today's lockdowns. I do see my 9-year-old son getting great satisfaction from the virtual world as the lockdown in London continues, literally since December last year. But personally, I am looking forward to escape virtuality, which probably makes me sound about 150-year-old. But going back to markets, the infamous FANMAG sector earnings went from being more than 13% of S&P earnings at the end of 2019 to more than a quarter of S&P earnings at the end of 2020. Those sectors' earnings growth, they won't fall out of bed in 2021. They're still expected to grow a honorable and probably overstretch medium rate of 20%. But that's actually down from 33% growth in 2020. Meanwhile, S&P operating EPS is likely to swing from minus 25 to plus 45 in 2021. Even more shockingly to younger generations, whilst credit growth is unlikely to revert to its pre-global financial crisis days, steeper curves means that traditionally boring bank forward earnings, a sector widely believed to be doomed to secular stagnations, are now rising faster than forward earnings in the tech sector. And you can see that for yourself on chart 6. So all in all, my considerations here really lead me to believe that the rationale for the large 250 basis point discount for the financial sector to the tech sector is really plummeting. So the change of leadership between growth and value and cyclical sector is not only a yield story. In fact, the differential in future earnings profile is a greatly overlooked driver of a sustainable rotation away from tech towards value and cyclicals outperformance. And you can see that for yourself on chart 7. So just a last chart to try and finish to convince you. So chart 8, I think you can really see, and that's really my opinion, that the powerful post-COVID reflationary backdrop necessitates a continued re-rating of financials versus the formerly hot FANMAG sector. And there is a potential just for convergence between earnings yield. There's a potential for a further 40% price rotation. So it's really an underlying trend that has potential and has really just started. Look, my message here is that the global equity market is potentially standing on steadier, not shakier ground, which means that S&P 500's equity risk premium is actually likely to fall going forward, eventually offsetting the effect of higher real yields on equity prices. And this is something I show on chart 9, and which also justifies selling VIX spikes in a structural positioning.
Juliet, you never cease to amaze me with your graphs and charts. I count 5 amazing charts on that one question about sector rotation. Let me hit you with another question that I've been asking almost all of our feature interview guests, which is, it sounds like you think that there's reason to expect higher yields, or that higher yields are warranted. If that's the case, how far can they let them go? You know, a narrative that you'll hear is the U.S. government cannot afford to allow the long end of the curve to go very far because they wouldn't be able to afford their debt service if it went beyond a certain level. Is that true? Is there a level that it can't go beyond? And what is that level? How far can yields go before they become restrictive?
So I think this is the $3 trillion question, which, as recently argued in a really interesting article from The Economist, which is titled, "The World's Consumers Are Sitting on a Pile of Cash, But Will They Spend It?" So I think this is what will ultimately drive the equilibrium real yield. As in my answer to your first question on whether we risk secular inflation, I want to really emphasize the high uncertainty but fundamental change in the skew around future inflation outcomes. And as a result, I really try and focus on what we do know and extrapolate from there in terms of finding out what is the most likely path in terms of yields and real yields and inflation. We, and I should say at least JDI Research clients and your regular listeners, know that financial repression, and what I mean by financial repression is negative interest rates and depressed term premia. That's basically led us to a much worse equilibrium over the last decade. Firstly, by constraining lending due to desperately tight bank margins. And if we're looking at Europe, especially, capital flows there are still relying heavily on banks. So it's a major consideration. And you can see that for yourself on chart 10. There is absolutely no question in my mind that banks are more likely to lend when it's profitable to do so, and that consumers are much more likely to borrow when they see a risk that rates may be moving higher rather than the opposite. Secondly, we've achieved an inferior macroeconomic equilibrium with financial repressions by incentivizing savings and basically constraining final demand in expectations of lower future earnings. So in other words, you have to save a lot more towards retirement if you expect that you will get no returns on your savings. And you can see that very clearly on chart 11. And that's really against all central banks' common economic sense. But you can see very clearly that low real interest rates have not been and are not stimulative. But hopefully, we are getting out of that pervasive depressionary cycle. And obviously, a third thing, and probably equally important, is the move to greater, quote-unquote, socialism in the US. So whilst in Europe and UK, the poorest were hardest hit financially by lockdowns, the same is not true in the US. According to Czech accounts data published by JP Morgan Institute, That's something you can see for yourself on chart 12. You can see that the poorest Czech accounts have increased by like 50% more than the wealthiest consumers. And I think it's a safe bet to say that Biden's administration will address inequalities much more systematically in the future, which will unleash untapped pockets of final demand, which will fuel a real recovery. Obviously, the poorest are more likely to spend than the wealthiest. So in sum, I think that should really take us to like a chart 13 of my chart pack. And you can see that these three considerations that, you know, we sort of like know for sure really justify markets pricing of a sustainable cyclical recovery. And that's actually what is priced in real yields by the markets. And we're still rising there and still in the process of repricing the cyclical recovery rather than in the process of ending this recovery. So assuming a persistent cyclical recovery, which is my belief, I think we can observe from chart 14 that the Fed front-end repricing is in fact massively lagging the spectacular improvement in the cyclical outlook, which is measured by the cyclical sector's outperformance versus defensive. There's another chart that I really like and which I updated today, which is Global Zoo, which we calculate internally. And you can see exactly the same thing over the past like four decades. It was basically directly leading Fed repricing. And now we're basically making new highs with the Fed hikes hardly being repriced at all. So all in all, my strong belief is that the front-end rates remain highly accommodative, even after bringing forward the expected timing of future policy rate increases.
Juliet, that's a great point. So I want to ask you, what do you think the Fed should do at this point?
I really believe that the Fed would be completely wrong to deviate from its sort of like laissez-faire attitude to a virtuous fundamental repricing and basically from its hands-off approach to the ongoing bear steepening. So what I expect Powell will stick to, you know, tomorrow and in the foreseeable future is a party line of infinite patience, but otherwise he will try to refrain from controlling yields. If and when markets start short-circuiting the recovery by front-running the upcoming economic recovery, the most likely answer will be a clarification of the Fed's forward guidance with a calendar guidance rather than the current obscure current reaction function. But we are like nowhere close to YCC, given how positive this repricing has been.
Juliet, may I ask you to now give us some concrete perspective on what you're actually advising your clients to do with all of this macro backdrop that we've discussed?
Well, the truth is that all the considerations we just discussed leave us with a continuation of the sleekest macroeconomic cycle experience I've seen in my career. So first, we priced reflation on the back of much lower real yields, and we valued growth sectors and generally all liquidity-driven sectors, and I'm talking gold, Bitcoin, metals, real estate, and emerging markets, of course. And that was the first part of the post-COVID repricing. Then cyclical earnings started to recover with less need for financial repression. And consequently, long-term real yields started to rise as they tend to mean revert to around an economy's potential. And that's really the point where I argued that the liquidity ship had sailed and recommended a strategic reset about last month. And in this move, there is still 50 basis points to go, in my opinion, in a motion that will take 10-year nominals well above 2% and 10-year real yields back to zero at a minimum. And we are currently around minus 70 basis points. And that will basically cap long-term breakevens. So in other words, I've moved this year from recommending that clients pay breakevens to recommending betting on higher real yields, which is now likely to lead nominal rates higher. And that's really a natural continuation of a cyclically grounded recovery.
Juliet, I know you caught a lot of our listeners' attention with your comment about real yields increasing from minus 70 bips to zero. That seems to be, or I should say that the trend in increasing real yields, in the opinion of a lot of analysts, is the reason we've seen weakness in the gold market. So I wonder if that means more weakness. So let's broaden that to both gold and the dollar. Tell us a little bit more about what this change in real yields is going to mean in terms of both of those things, the dollar index as well as gold.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in fact, gold this year has like sort of like tripped me over. And I'll tell you why, because I think it will answer your question. Basically, I came this year with a very strong view that the US real yield curve would continue to steepen. And that's worked very well. But the challenge is, what does it mean for all assets? So what I really did not expect to happen as quickly as it has, and this really, I think, will be the typical Q1 catch that might be continuing into the rest of the year, was for the real yield bull steepening to turn so fast into a real bear steepening. So what we had last year was the real yield curve overall steepening, but with a weight down, and we're now like basically pivoting higher. And what this move is doing, and basically spells the beginning of the end of financial repression, and that of a macro cycle which relies purely on excess liquidity and fast and easy financial asset appreciation. And that's really why I recommended last month to, and that was premature in my initial framework, to get out of, to take profit in short dollar and also take profit in long EM recommendation. And that also led me to take a loss in the long gold recommendation I had. Going forward, with the Fed likely to follow rather than lead market pricing on yields, there is really no reason to believe that U.S. financial conditions will become too tight for the U.S. or for the rest of the world, indeed. So this leaves us, as we discussed in earlier question, with still a positive global recessionary stance, which is a clear signal for the greenback, a clear bearish signal for the greenback, and it would be for gold as well. And that's something you can see on chart 15. Also, front-end real yields differential still indicate a continuation of the dollar downward trend, as shown on chart 16. But really, this is where it gets more confusing and why I'm actually no longer recommending either long gold or short dollar. Rather than over-promising and under-delivering, the opposite has happened, and Biden has basically outdone the wildest market expectations in terms of fiscal stimuli. And that's really allowed markets to price a much faster return to trend growth in the US. And as a result, whilst I initially expected long-end real yields to just grind higher as the front end collapsed, which was justifying long gold and short dollar, the new dynamic, which I think will be perseverant, is one of a long-end upward trend. So that's where we're talking from, like going from minus 70 to zero, which is actually resulting from lower front-end real yields. So that's what I call basically the higher long-end real yields are now leaking into the front end. And this move is likely to continue accelerate upon economic reopening and support the dollar. And this is a dynamic I pictured on chart 17. It's especially true because the Fed now appears more likely to accommodate higher term premia than its DM counterparts. We've seen recently the RBA, the ECB, really pushing back on strongly on higher term premia. I think eventually the ECB, the RBA, and even the BOJ, which is now talking about allowing more of a free float of the tenure as part of its review, I think they will all come to the view I expressed in this interview and in the report I published, that steeper curves are absolutely conducive to much looser financial conditions. And that will eventually allow the dollar downtrend to reassert itself. But I think we're not there yet. So really, to answer your question more clearly, I'm a bit ambivalent about the dollar, and I've given up on gold after like a fantastic in 2010-20. Really, it was central to be long gold in my recommendations. And now, because we are looking at higher yields being driven more than by real yields than by breakevens, I think gold will lose an anchor. So I'm really going to be looking for opportunities to trade extremes in the dollar with a view to eventually re-embracing our bearish outlook. But for now, it's really on ice and not warranted.
Juliet, I want to go a little bit further on gold, if we can. I couldn't agree with you more that it feels to me like gold has further to go to the downside. And the reason is increasing real 10-year yields. It feels to me like this is a gift, an opportunity. And of course, it's always hard to time exactly where market bottoms are. But it feels to me like we're coming into a buying zone where there's going to be a long-term opportunity. And that, at least in my thinking, is based entirely on an expectation that inflation is coming. And I think it's coming in a big way. And when that inflation is actually registered, we're going to realize that real yields, even with nominal yields backing up, real yields really are returning to negatives. And at that point, I think gold really takes off. I'm just curious, since a lot of our listeners have been following the gold market very closely, would you agree or disagree with that view and why?
Yeah, so I think I completely agree with the first half of your question. You're thinking that we haven't seen the bottom. We haven't seen enough of a correction in gold to re-enter here. I did consider recommending to sell gold, but when I've got a strong view, I try to go to where really to the root of my macro thinking. And my macro thinking really is that real yields will go up. I'll tell you why I recommended short tips rather than anything else, is that I feel the biggest risk to my reflationary view at the moment is indeed inflation. And inflation, which like an oil shock, would basically be shocking demand negatively, in which case I think the inflation curve would be like collapsing, basically inverting and collapsing, which basically means that real yields would be shooting up. So I quite like the idea, given I've been recommending a strong beta to risk assets, to have this sort of like bubble where I think real yields go up in a reflationary scenario, but it could also be like shocked higher in a deflationary scenario brought about by higher inflation. So I would agree with your scenario on gold. And it's really a matter of probably looking at the shape of the curve, really, the shape of the break-even curve and the shape of the real yield curve.
Juliet, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at JDI Research. And I know in the past, we've managed to wrestle a special offer for Macro Voices listeners on a trial to your service. Is that still a possibility?
So what I do at JDI Research first, so I advise institutional clients, but I also have like a small pocket of retail or high net worth investors that have been following my views and benefited from my recommendations over the past 5 years and, you know, generally happy clients. What I do over every Macro Voices interview, which only happens basically twice a year, is I try and offer those Macro Voices listeners a small discount on a 1 year subscription. And that's something that I will be happy again to extend to your listeners. And I really emphasize the fact that I only do it twice a year and only over Macro Voices interviews.
Well, Juliet, I look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Serezna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Run your operations like a well-oiled machine with SS&C EZ. Automate daily tasks, eliminate manual processes, and minimize risk. SS&C EZ has been providing award-winning solutions backed by unparalleled client service for over 25 years. Today, they're helping 1,900 hedge funds, family offices, and asset managers transform their investment process and grow their business. SS&C EZ delivers cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to maximize efficiencies across the entire investment process for all asset classes. Their solutions are easy to use with friction-free integration into your downstream systems. Meet investor, regulatory, and due diligence requirements, all while lowering cost of ownership. Set your business up for rapid growth and download their free guide at ezsoft.com/macro. That's ezsoft.com/macro.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was a great interview with Juliette Declercq. I really enjoyed her entire segment on the rotation in the markets, and that's something that I want to continue that conversation with this chart deck.
All righty. Well, the download link is in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads, just above Juliette's picture, just below the green Donate button. Patrick, the chart deck is called Is Volatility Set to Return? Well, it already returned to the crude oil market today. What's going on with the S&P on page two?
Well, you know, we are right now in the quad witching at the time of recording, which is the big option expiration roll-off. And we have generally a gamma pin that occurs in this window, which is essentially the market is naturally drawn to tighter trade ranges going into that expiry. But what that does and what we typically do see is things become volatile in the week after. And this is what's really interesting. So right now, the market kind of came to where all these major strike prices are had the huge open interest between 3,900, 3,950, and 4,000 on the S&P. And what's going to be really interesting here is whether that brings about that new volatility and which direction that volatility will be. I mean, while I'm not opposed to it going higher, there are some warning signs that there could also be a bit of a correction coming on the other end. So I want to talk about that. So this S&P chart, all I really want to highlight here on page two is so far, the 50-day moving average has held. We did temporarily poke below it, but overall, at least on the S&P 500 front, the trend remains somewhat intact. But what is interesting, Eric, if we go to page three, is where the real actual performance is occurring. And so I have here the S&P 500 equal weight ETF, which kind of balances out those big behemoth FANG stocks that dominate the S&P 500. And what's really amazing is that this is actually where the market has been performing. And even on page four, we can see the performance comparison of the equal weight S&P versus the index itself. The index is up 20% and the equal weight is up 32%. And that's largely because those value sectors and cyclicals, everything from energy stocks to the financials, have just been where all of the major performance has been. And just like Juliette was talking about, it may even continue. And it's really interesting to see that's that underpinning almost real economy stocks that are driving this trend. But what is also interesting on page five is the NASDAQ, and particularly the fact that those really big behemoth stocks like the Apples and even the Teslas continue to actually be actively distributed. This really kind of tells the tale of the rotation that we have been seeing in this market. And while the S&P 500 and the equal weight and the Russell and the Dow have all roared to higher highs, the NASDAQ is nowhere near doing so. In fact, it's been just a Fibonacci retrace bounce off of that low, and it looks like it's rolling over and may very well even stay below the 50-day moving average on today's close. And so really, the question I have is that can the S&P 500 hold up if the NASDAQ isn't done selling? And I think that's one of the big puzzle pieces that I'm going to be trying to solve next week as to whether or not there's another round of selling and distribution in those FANG stocks and the NASDAQ itself versus the S&P 500. And will that be something that drags it down with it?
Now, tell me about page six and the momentum to value ratio. That's a ratio we don't see too often. What does that one mean?
Well, I just took the momentum ETF versus the value ETF, and it really continues to just support what we were just talking about, which is that it's those the momentum growth names that are really being actively sold, while those value stocks are actually where the performance continues to be. What doesn't show on here is that this has been a 3-4 year trend where that momentum has really been dominant, and it really now has been almost 6 months that the value stocks have really been outperforming, and it really feels like some sort of a trend. And I guess so long as yields keep pressing higher, I don't see why this can't continue.
Patrick, let's move on to the reflation trade that we've talked about in a few past episodes. Look at the dollar index. Well, it's still nicely above its 50-day moving average. What do you make of this chart?
Well, you know, I think that it's a very simple thing to just observe that 50-day moving average, because of the very nature of what a moving average is just the average price of the last 50 days. There has been a very distinct downtrend in the dollar that's been dominant through the entire, most of the 2020 year, which has sustained the US dollar below that 50-day moving average. And the fact that we are now going, 2-3 weeks of the US dollar consolidating above it, it does ask that question as to whether this is developing into a trend change. One thing we can say is that bearish US dollar trade has been consensus. It's been a very crowded trade. And the question really becomes is that is there room for the dollar to offer a short squeeze where everyone in this crowded trade is shaken out with a little bit of a spike? I don't think we need to have a true macro fundamental backdrop for a shakeout like that to occur just because it's such a popular trade. Eric, I wanted to move on to page 9, where I have the crude oil chart, and this is particularly the April contract. And I drew on that trend line that you were talking about in the market wrap, and I wanted your take on this. But one observation I'll make before we get your take on it is the fact that that entire rally that occurred on the OPEC meeting has now been given back. And one of the characteristics that I always look for in price action is whether or not the sequence of higher highs and higher lows can be maintained. And with the fact that we are giving back that entire breakout, it does make me suspect that this is getting very heavy. Now, we don't, like you were suggesting in the market wrap, it doesn't have to be a bear market in crude or some really ugly bloodbath, but we are long overdue for a correction, and maybe this is where that correction has begun.
Well, Patrick, this red trend line that you see, as you say, has been in place since November, and we did break down and close below it today. On this particular chart, you see it says 61.04 there. That was taken just a few minutes before we started recording this segment, and already, as we got into the pit close, we ended up down to 59.70 as we speak at about 3 p.m. So we're already below the line there, and that is a breakdown below a trend line that was in place for, you know, at least 4 months or so, and now we're breaking down below it. Is that just because we're going to consolidate sideways here, or are we going back to the 40s? I really don't know. I do think that this is a long overdue pause or pullback in a healthy bull market. I definitely don't think that was the top at $68. I think that before the year is out, we're going higher. Question is, do we consolidate for another 6 months or for just another 6 days? We'll see what happens. And I also want to point out, Patrick, on the gasoline futures chart that we broke a trend line there. And more importantly, we closed below the 21-day moving average on RBOB gasoline. That, when you close below all of the short-term moving averages, it's often a sign of a trend change in the entire energy complex.
Yeah, and the observation I'd also make on gasoline was that it has actually been the relative outperformer in the space. So since the November swing low, while we saw crude oil advancing 60%, gasoline futures were up 90% to their recent high. And that's really allowed crack spreads to widen, and it's been a real driver in all of this. And so it really does feel like some sort of a more meaningful market correction has really begun, because it's really happening quite broadly in most energy markets. Anyway, Eric, what I wanted to do, though, is continue talking about some of these other commodities, and particularly I want to now focus on copper. And so on page 11, we have that copper chart. And what's interesting is that copper has not done anything really bearish yet, but we have now seen at least a swing high establish itself back in February. And when we look at it just technically, there was every reason for copper to have already broken out on the upside. And really, in the end, we're now like week after week just sideways consolidating here. And when I really start kind of stepping back and looking at this, even when we look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index on page 12, the entire commodity complex seems to have really run out of short-term gas. And really, it has been an amazing trend move that has established itself over almost a year's time now. And we are overdue for a correction. And it will be really interesting to see whether all of these different commodities continue this correction, and if it does so, what will it do to inflation expectations?
Patrick, let's move on to inflation expectations. We've got 30-year break-evens on page 13. What's this chart telling us?
Well, this is interesting to me because really, even after we had the FOMC meeting, the 30-year break-evens have not let up. We continue to see them crawling higher. Inflation expectations continue to rise. And I ask the question is, if we see that the dollar potentially may break out, because we have, I wouldn't want to call it a breakout yet, and we have commodities coming off their highs, is that the conditions from which these break-evens will can also finally begin some sort of a correction on the downside? And I think that that's something to watch, because we're really not seeing any confirmation on this break-evens chart. It just continues to plug away higher.
And folks, don't forget you can get a free 14-day trial to Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, and get chart decks like this every day of the week. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by SS&C EZ, delivering cutting-edge cloud, mobile, and on-premise solutions to optimize operational and investment alpha across the entire investment process. Listeners, if you haven't yet taken advantage of a free subscription to our Research Roundup email newsletter, please do so. You can do that by clicking the red button that says Looking for the Downloads on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Juliet's slide deck and the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to an article from Jeffrey Snyder that the FOMC statement makes a statement without really knowing it, and a link to a Ray Dalio article, Bullish Stuff, Bearish Stupid, and Short Cash. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MBRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.